Welcome to Talking History. This is your host, Brian LeBeau. The radio show Amos and Andy originated on WMAQ in Chicago on March 19, 1928. It became the longest-running radio program in broadcast history, making it to television for a two-year run beginning in 1951. Conceived by two white actors who portrayed the lead characters by stereotyping and mimicking African-American behavior, Amos and Andy also became one of the most controversial programs in media history. In this week's show, Talking History's James Madison discusses Amos and Andy with Melvin Patrick Ely, author of The Adventure of Amos and Andy, A Social History of an American Phenomenon. Following that, Eleazar Barkin will offer us his thoughts on whether reparations can heal the wounds of slavery. But before we get to those subjects, Joey Skidmore takes a look at an important event that occurred this week in history.
On July 30, 1863, Henry Ford, the American industrialist who revolutionized factory production, was born on a farm near Dearborn, Michigan. Ford was one of eight children. He attended a one-room school until the age of 15, and then left for Detroit, where he worked in the city's machine shops and for the Westinghouse Engine Company. In 1893, he was made chief engineer at Detroit Edison. In the same year, Ford built his first gasoline-powered engine, which, in 1896, he transformed into his first horseless carriage, the quadricycle. In 1899, he joined a small group of investors in creating the Detroit Automobile Company. But in 1903, he struck out on his own. The Ford Motor Company was successful from the start, but it was his Model T, marketed in 1908, that brought him fame and fortune. In the 19th year of the Model T's existence, he sold over 16.5 million of the cars in the United States and abroad, a production total amounting to half the auto output in the world. Ford accomplished this by employing the assembly line, which, at its peak in 1915, could produce a Model T every 24 seconds at a cost of $490. A year earlier, in 1914, Ford stunned the industry when he raised his workers' wages to the unheard-of amount of $5 a day and shortened their work week from 9 to 8 hours. The Model T changed the nation. Common people, as well as the rich, could own the Model T. Farmers were no longer isolated. The horse disappeared so rapidly that the transfer of acreage from hay to other crops caused an agricultural revolution. Cities spread outward, creating suburbs. And the nation built the most extensive highway system in the world.
The enduring mystery of the Anne Frank story is who betrayed her to the Nazis. Anne and her family hid for 25 months in a canalside warehouse in Amsterdam, where the teenager wrote into notebooks her thoughts, yearnings, and descriptions of life around her. First published in English in 1952 as The Diary of a Young Girl, and later as a stage play and film, her story made her a symbol of the Holocaust. Nevertheless, the Franks were found and taken off to a concentration camp where Anne died. And for more than 20 years, warehouse employee Willem von Marin was suspected of tipping off authorities. Now, Carol Ann Lee, author of The Hidden Life of Otto Frank, has offered a new theory. She points to a former business associate of Otto Frank, Anne's father, Anton Ehlers. In an interview with Dutch television, the British writer explained, "Everyone, including his own family, condemned him as distinctly anti-Jewish and a thoroughly unpleasant character." Whether Lee has enough evidence to make her case against Ehlers, however, remains to be seen. This is Talking History.
The Amos and Andy Show.
Amos and Andy's portrayal of black life and culture was deemed by the black community of the period to be an insulting return to the days of blackface and minstrelsy. Eventually, the controversy surrounding the television version almost equaled that of the popularity of the radio version. Talking History's James Madison, professor of history at Indiana University, talks about the controversy surrounding Amos and Andy with his guest, Melvin Patrick Ely.
The American fascination with early radio comedy continues. Few, if any, of the early radio shows are more fascinating than Amos and Andy. Yet this program, with white actors playing the roles of two black men, Amos and Andy, was always controversial, as it was popular, and remains so today. Our guest is Melvin Patrick Ely, professor of history and black studies at the College of William and Mary, Professor Ely is the author of a book titled The Adventure of Amos and Andy, A Social History of an American Phenomenon, a book that's just been published in a 10th anniversary edition with a new preface by the University of Virginia Press. Welcome, Melvin Ely.
Thanks very much.
Let's begin with just a description of these two characters, and they really were characters. Who was Amos? Who was Andy?
Amos and Andy were depicted as two black characters, young men, who were doing what tens of thousands of real African-Americans were doing in the 20s when this radio show originated, namely moving out of the rural South to the big northern city to seek their fortunes. Amos was a meek, unassuming, high-voiced, moral, diligent fellow, and Andy was a low-voiced blowhard whose pretensions to urban sophistication constantly foundered on the shoals of his own ignorance. He was sort of the type who always had a scheme to get ahead and ended up failing and yet bossing Amos around. So they were kind of a complementary pair.
And listeners, I assume, would tend to laugh more at Andy than at Amos, or not?
Actually, the humor was pretty well distributed between the two of them. An interesting thing about Amos and Andy was that it didn't take the common pattern of straight line, punchline, straight line, punchline. So each of the characters got his licks in.
Mm-hmm. But Amos and Andy were played by two men who were not black.
That's right. That's right. The creators of Amos and Andy, and by the way, they played all the roles, the many roles in the series for the first 10 years or so, by themselves, were Charles Correll of Peoria, Illinois, and Freeman Gosden of Richmond, Virginia, both of whom were born toward the end of the 19th century, and who had met when they were working as professional directors of blackface minstrel shows. So they had roots in a very old manner of depicting African Americans with white actors, and they made the transition from that tradition-bound genre into radio and created Amos and Andy.
Can you tell us a little bit more about blackface minstrel shows? What are those, and
well,
how do they relate?
The minstrel show actually was created in the big cities of the North before the Civil War. It's a combination of music, dance, and comedy in which white men would black their faces and purport to imitate the culture and the ways of African Americans. And it's a form that was in its heyday around the Civil War years, but actually survived well into the 20th century, at least on the amateur stage.
But how is this program, Amos and Andy, different from those kinds of 19th century minstrel shows? Is it the same thing, or is it different?
Well, in some ways it's similar, because the minstrel show, of course, being put on by whites in a race-conscious society, spent a good deal of its time making fun of blacks and caricaturing them. And there's certainly that element in Amos and Andy. There are, in fact, entire episodes that are sort of vaudeville or minstrel show-type set pieces where Amos and Andy are struggling over trying to balance the books of their little business and demonstrating their complete incompetence in arithmetic or something of that sort. But Amos and Andy was also very different in that, besides being a comedy, it was a continuing story. It was broadcast daily for 15 minutes. And Gosden and Correll were masters at creating characters whom people in the audience could actually come to care about. They could build suspense. They could broadcast cliffhanger episodes to the point where I, when researching the book and reading the scripts, found myself eager often to find out what would happen to these characters the next day. So that's really what hooked America. The fact that there's the sort of comfortable minstrel-style comedy that white people were used to, but there's also often element that grabs the even the emotions and tugs at the heartstrings at times.
Can you give us an example of that human element, that universal quality that you find in the Amos and Andy shows?
One example would be a series of episodes in which Ruby Taylor, who's the fiance of Amos, becomes sick. And at the beginning of the week, there's some mention that she has the sniffles, and by the middle of the week, it's a cold. And by Thursday, it's pneumonia, and on Friday evening, she's in the hospital, and at the end of the episode, the listener is given the impression that, that maybe she has just died. And then the listener has to wait through a day's hiatus and tune in again 2 days later to find out, is Ruby dead or is she alive? And the amount of fan mail that something like that would demonstrate and the emotional investment people made in whether Ruby lived or Ruby died is exactly what I'm talking about when I speak of the empathy that these shows could evoke.
So you're suggesting that white listeners became intimately connected to this character who was clearly an African-American woman, Ruby.
Yes, and it may be that this could only have happened in radio. I read this morning where the new managing editor of Rolling Stone magazine said that all the great media adventures of the 20th century have been visual, which completely ignores the fact that the two dominant media of the mid-century were movies and radio, and in radio, the visual dimension is there, but it's entirely in the mind of each individual listener. So the race of the characters is certainly there, and it's unmistakable because of the caricatured dialect. And yet each person, and yet the race is not thrown in your face the way it would be on a television screen. The listener, I think, found it easier to empathize precisely because he or she could create images of these characters in his or her own mind.
Mm-hmm. Can you say more about radio and radio in the 20s and 30s, the late 20s and 30s, when Amos and Andy was so popular? More about listeners and the nature of the shows and of comedy shows like this and what appealed to people?
Well, radio in the 20s, and that's the decade in which commercial radio emerged, really, until Amos and Andy, basically consisted of broadcasts of performances that you could see in a theater or a vaudeville house or something of the sort. Radio hadn't done anything new except to transmit the stuff electronically. Amos and Andy is the show that made radio a medium in its own right. The sale of radios skyrocketed because of Amos and Andy, because they did something that the vaudeville stage couldn't do and that the movies couldn't do, and that is to tell this continuing story day after day after day for months and months at a time. And the response was overwhelming. The Amos and Andy series in the early years had a listenership of about 40 million. This in a country that had a population of only 125 million at the time. Restaurants, hotel lobbies, movie theaters would pipe in the nightly broadcast for 15 minutes because they would lose their clientele otherwise. Factory shifts, shift changes were rescheduled. And you could literally walk down the street of an American city on a summer evening when everyone's windows would be open, and not miss a word of Amos and Andy, because almost every radio would be tuned to it. So there's a way in which radio made Amos and Andy, but even more so, I think Amos and Andy made radio as a medium.
Yes, and this was a 15-minute show every weeknight?
Six nights a week.
Six
usually,
nights
yes.
A week. Yeah. Was it live or recorded?
It was live. It was in the very first days, they Gosden and Carell also recorded their shows actually on discs and distributed them around the country that way. But by the time the show came onto the network in 1929, it was live. You bet. It didn't matter where in the country they were; they would broadcast that show by remote feed over NBC.
Mm-hmm. Well, as popular as it was also controversial. And you write in your book, The Adventures of Amos and Andy, about an early controversy in 1931. Can you tell us about that?
Yes. The Amos and Andy show had a huge following among both African-Americans and whites. But there was also black protest almost from the beginning. What happened in 31 was that the editor of the Pittsburgh Courier, which was one of the two most popular African-American weekly newspapers mounted a petition campaign among blacks demanding that the show be taken off the air on the grounds that white actors were exploiting black stereotypes, and that in doing this, they were holding back the progress of the black race by depicting African Americans as incompetent. And during the course of 1931, Robert Vann, that newspaper editor, claimed, and I think probably plausibly, to have collected something like 750,000 black signatures demanding that Amos and Andy be removed. This at the same time that tens of thousands of other African Americans were listening to the show and delighting in it. I mean, we have vivid vignettes of scenes in Harlem where African Americans who were too poor to have radios would gather at barbershops or outside radio stores, even on the sidewalk, to listen to this show, partly because Gosden and Carell actually lifted their style and some of their material even from the most popular black acts of the time, especially Miller and Lyles, a famous comedy team. And a lot of black folk tuned in this show for months before they found out that these were even white actors.
So you're suggesting then that this controversy in 1931 leads to a conclusion that there is no such thing as the black voice, or I guess in this case the black ear, in terms of listening to Amos and Andy. Can you distinguish that a little bit? Why would some African Americans be so strongly opposed to this program while others would be so supportive of it and eager to hear it?
Those who were eager to hear it, I think, were so for a couple of reasons. One is they found the show, surprising to us in 2002, authentic. It sounded so much like certain genuine styles of African-American humor that were prevalent at the time that it was just natural to tune in, into this show and laugh along with it. Another reason that many blacks felt free to enjoy the show, especially African-Americans in the middle class, was that they felt that Amos and Andy was depicting a type of black American other than themselves. There are many letters and other evidence that we have in which middle-class black folk, especially in the North, write, I've known a lot of black folk in the South who were just like Amos and Andy, and aren't they quaint and aren't they funny? And therefore, to laugh at them was not to laugh at oneself, or even to admit that that the middle class is being depicted here at all. Now, on the other hand, you have black Americans who conclude that white America listens to this show and makes up its mind that all blacks are as depicted here. And if you think that, then you're going to want this thing taken off the air pronto.
Right. Let's move forward from this debate over the show in 1931, when it's a radio show, to 1951, when it becomes a TV show. And again, the controversy flares up at this point.
Yes, and that's a little bit ironic, because when the CBS network decided to make the transition of Amos and Andy to television, they actually tried to, as they say, clean up the show a little bit. They tried to eliminate some of the more blatant stereotypes, understanding that the country really had changed between 1928 and 1951. The experience of the radio show itself proves this. But you will find depictions in white newspapers of events, personal appearances by the Amos and Andy duo in the early 30s, in which a white reporter writing for white readers will emphasize how Amos and Andy never make fun of the black race. And I try to figure out why in 1931, when the United States couldn't even pass a federal anti-lynching bill, any white person would think that other whites cared what black folks think. And what I see happening is that little by little, many whites are getting to the point where they're going to tune in Amos and Andy anyhow, but they can feel just a little bit better about it if they think that blacks aren't offended. And this is the sentiment that CBS was trying to tap into in 51. What they didn't realize was when you clean up the set, you create a visual image, you have an apartment where the central character by 51, the Kingfish, lives, and it's a middle-class apartment. Amos, Andy, and the Kingfish are dressed in middle-class clothes, but they're still speaking the same dialect and getting into the same situations, that you're delivering the message, potentially, that you can, no matter how much you clean up these characters, no matter how much you urbanize the black American, he's still going to be like Amos and Andy in 1928. Mm-hmm. The NAACP looks at this. Walter White, the head of the NAACP, had been fighting stereotypes in Hollywood movies for a dozen years. He's thinking, here comes television, a new medium. It's a new page in media history where blacks will be portrayed in a progressive way. Along comes the first program to depict an all-black cast, and it's one that harks back to 1928. Right. So the NAACP protests vociferously.
Right. We have time for just another question. Mel, is there still fear of talking about Amos and Andy today, of talking about it honestly?
I'll tell you, I think there's a lot less fear than there was when I first published this book. The reception of the book is proof of that, in that an awful lot of white and black commentators seem to welcome the chance to talk about Amos and Andy and look back and see what it had all meant. And yet, even today, there is fear, mostly among certain white Americans. There are black Americans who have bitter memories of Amos and Andy and would rather it not be brought up. But among whites, I'll give you an example. If there was a movie producer not long ago who was looking at the possibility of making a docudrama about the Amos and Andy experience, he canvassed about half a dozen writers, potential script writers, four or five of whom loved the idea. And one, whose name every listener would recognize, said, "Oh, my God, I couldn't touch that with a 10-foot pole. I'd get in all sorts of trouble." Mm-hmm. So there are still mainly white folks today who are afraid to touch the subject.
Right, right. Well, thank you, Mr. Ely. We've been talking today with Melvin Ely, the author of The Adventure of Amos and Andy, A Social History of an American Phenomenon.
Andy gets their body pounded. Up and gets the fat beat off of them. Oh, I tell you, they is getting slap happy around that age.
Yes, I know. Mud packs and everything.
Yeah, don't tell me about mud packs. I remember one night in the dark, I goes to kiss my wife with a heart full of love. I winds up with a mouth full of dirt.
Continuing on the subject of Amos and Andy, Joey Skidmore is back to tell you about the original Amos and Andy webpage.
Located at geocities.com/Hollywood, the original Amos and Andy webpage offers just about everything anyone interested in the show, radio and television versions, might want to know. Click on the discussion group and post your ideas and questions about the show. Go to video sources and find out where you can purchase videotapes and audio cassettes of the television and radio programs. There's lots of history available on the show, as well as extensive information on the cast. The original Amos and Andy webpage lists the episodes of the show and includes several sound files. It even includes a list of commercial sponsors, a section devoted to the controversy surrounding Amos and Andy, and the text of an article written by the creators of the show, Charles Carell and Freeman Gostin, in 1942, titled, "If We Had It to Do Over Again." Check it out at geocities.com/Hollywood.
And if you're interested in old-time radio and television, we recommend a visit to the Museum of Television and Radio in Los Angeles and New York City. Both locations offer daily screenings and radio presentations of a wide variety of programs from the museum's large collection of television and radio classics. Both house extensive research libraries open to the public and offer regularly scheduled seminars, lectures, and performances. Current exhibits at both venues include Cartoon Power, David Bowie, Sound and Vision, and a tribute to Richard Rodgers. The Los Angeles Museum of Television and Radio is at 465 North Beverly Drive. The New York branch is at 25 West 52nd Street.
Come on, Andy, let's get going.
And finally, we turn to our commentary of the week. Can reparations heal the wounds of slavery? By Eleazar Barkin. Barkin is a professor of history and chair of the Cultural Studies Department at Claremont Graduate School in California. He's the author of The Guilt of Nations, Restitution in Negotiating Historical Injustices.
A group of African Americans is demanding in federal court in New York that the United States acknowledge its culpability in the practice of slavery. The class action suit filed last month against three American corporations that benefited from slavery faces major obstacles, not least of which is the lack of legal precedent or clear historical analogy. Although the litigation arouses great fear among critics, past cases of reparations elsewhere indicate that the slavery lawsuit could become an invaluable tool for bridging the racial divide in America. It's doubtful the suit will successfully raid the coffers of American corporations. Some people object to the court filing because the potential beneficiaries are not direct victims. To counter the criticism, one of the plaintiff's lawyers has promised that no individual descendants of slaves will benefit from financial settlement. Instead, any damages awarded from the suit will be used to create a social fund to improve health, education, and housing for African Americans. This is unnecessarily apologetic, because it is well established that descendants of victims are entitled to damages. Nobody would deny a wrongful death suit because the victim is deceased. Shouldn't descendants of slaves also be viewed as victims? True. Two of the most famous historical cases of reparations, Japanese Americans placed in internment camps during World War II, and slave laborers used by German corporations during the same period, compensated only surviving victims. However, in addition, descendants of survivors did receive compensation for lost property. Neither group needed to legitimize their claims by denying themselves personal benefit. These precedents provide only general principles, and the differences are too significant to allow a simple comparison. Slavery was not limited to several years, nor have the economic losses of African Americans ever been determined in any formal way. While a communal benefit may be the most moral solution to a slavery settlement, let's not forget that the suffering was and is personal. If the class action suit proceeds far enough through the legal system, and perhaps even reaches the stage of exploring remedies, public discussion is likely to provide momentum for a congressional hearing. An eminent persons committee might even be appointed to study the question of reparations. Here is the question that should be on the congressional inquisitor's lips. How much worse off are descendants of slaves because of lingering racism? That issue would be immensely controversial. The answer, more so. But this is the normal course of political debate, and we shouldn't shy away from it because it is uncomfortable. Despite widely differing public viewpoints, such a discussion may encourage policymakers and ultimately the public to agree on a number that will at last acknowledge the extent of the national debt for African American suffering. Perhaps most important, the reckoning and the possible partial reparation could facilitate a healing process between the races, which can only start the acknowledgement of guilt.
You've been listening to Eleazar Barkin, author of The Guilt of Nations, Restitution and Negotiating Historical Injustices. And that's it for another week of Talking History. I hope you've enjoyed the show. We invite you to send us your comments or suggestions either by email at talkinghistory@umkc.edu or by U.S. mail Talking History, care of the Department of History, University of Missouri, Kansas City, Kansas City, Missouri, 64110. Talking History is a production of the Organization of American Historians. Information about the OAH and Talking History is available at oah.org. Until next time, this is Brian Levine.
I ain't never seen a mustache with so much wax on it before in my life. Why, if you would put a match to that thing, it would burn for an hour.
Information.